Is the world overpopulated? Should we be more concerned with depopulation rather than overpopulation? Hi, you're tuned into The Commonwealth Matters, and I'm your host, Richard Nelson. Joining us to talk further is Lyman Stone, a senior fellow and director of the Pronatalism Initiative at the Institute for Family Studies. Lyman is also the chief information officer of the consulting firm Demographic Intelligence and a PhD student at McGill University. His work on family formation and demographics has been covered in many publications, including the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. Lyman currently lives in Lexington, Kentucky, with his wife and three daughters. Lyman, welcome to the Commonwealth Matters.
It's great to be with you.
I want to start the conversation on demographics with a book that was released in 1969 by a university professor named Paul Ehrlich. He wrote a book called The Population Bomb, and he made the claim that overpopulation in the world will lead to famine and millions of deaths, hundreds of millions of deaths, by the 1980s. And this is what he asked: what needs to be done? And he said, we must rapidly bring the world population under control, reducing the growth rate to zero or making it negative. Conscious regulation of human numbers must be achieved. Simultaneously, we must at least temporarily greatly increase our food production. Now, Lyman, you and I and those who pay attention to this know that his prediction was wildly inaccurate, never happened. In fact, there was greater food production in that period of time, and the average life expectancy increased over that period of time as well. And yet, there is still a view today that the world is overpopulated. In particular, that it's wreaking havoc on the environment and on our well-being. So we know that his prediction, his theory was false, didn't happen, but there's still this prevailing myth, if you will, that overpopulation prevails and we've got to do something about it. How do you explain that?
So humans, we tend to be scarcity reasoners. You know, most of our history was subsistence farming or hunter-gathering or whatever. And so we tend to just default towards being really worried about where our next meal is going to be from. And so scarcity reasoning dominates a lot of our thinking, which is unfortunate because throughout human history, the scarcity mindset has actually usually been wrong. That is, humans have always been able to modify their environments, modify their communities, modify the way that they live in the world in order to exceed the limits of scarcity. We invented fire. We invented agriculture. We domesticated animals. We invented plows and fertilizers and exchange and all these things. And of course, now, genetically modified seeds that fended off starvation, frankly, and other agricultural improvements around the world. So yeah, we avoided the population bomb. Of course, it was always pretty obvious that we were going to avoid the population bomb at the time that Ehrlich was writing. Fertility was already falling in much of the world, and agricultural yields were already rising at historically unprecedented levels. But it wasn't just Ehrlich saying this. There was a whole zeitgeist at the time. I mean, the U.S. government was expansively supporting family planning programs around the world as part of an effort to fight communism. The belief was if population growth is too fast, there will be excess laborers who will be unhappy with their lot in life and they will fuel communist revolutions. So there was lots of people had lots of reasons to be interested in this overpopulation argument, when the reality is underpopulation is a much more severe threat. This one, it's not that we're just going to run out of food. It's not that the technology is just going to suddenly stop working, but there will be real economic challenges associated with long-term low fertility, real social challenges. And we do not currently have a ready solution on hand. And there's no underlying social trend pointing in an obvious direction to offset falling fertility.
Lyman, putting together some of my notes for this program, I did a quick internet search about organizations that are dedicated to reducing the world population, and there's a whole bunch of them in this country, internationally. And their goal is to decrease the world population. So here's a few names: the International Planned Parenthood, the Population Institute, of course, the United Nations Population Fund. And listen to what their mission is. Their mission is to deliver a world where every pregnancy is wanted, every childbirth is safe, and every young person's potential is fulfilled. Now, that sounds good. I think we could all be in favor of that. But one of the threads that runs true for all of these groups is that they are working for depopulation, if you will, under the guise of reproductive health, reproductive rights, and which essentially that's translated to mean abortion. All of these groups are pro-abortion groups. They have the belief, again, that there's too many people, but they've somehow convinced women in particular that a pregnancy or a child could hold you back. And they've convinced not just women as individuals, but they've convinced entire societies that too many people and that really children are holding you back to reach your full potential, like the United Nations Population Fund is saying here.
It's important to talk about this whole wantedness element. Because obviously we do want people to achieve their family goals, okay? And if somebody says, I want zero children, you know, I don't want to force them to have kids that they don't want to have. Partly because we also know sociologically that if somebody doesn't want kids and then they have a child, that child's odds of experiencing early death and child abuse are much higher. So it's not that we want to like make people have unwanted kids or something, but it's amazing how groups like UNFPA that you mentioned, they say where every pregnancy is wanted. And they see that as saying by getting rid of unwanted pregnancies, okay? But you could also say by changing the circumstances of family and pregnancy such that those pregnancies become wanted, right? They only see one side of this, and that's reducing pregnancy to match wantedness. And it's like beyond their imagination that maybe there are problems in society that you could fix that would cause wantedness, the number of pregnancies that people are comfortable and happy with, to rise. Beyond that, it's worth noting that the share of pregnancies that people report wanting, that is, that are intended, you might think like in Africa, 70% of pregnancies are unwanted, but in America, you know, only 20% of pregnancies are unwanted. No. In Africa, in Asia, in Europe, in the US, around the world, a pretty more or less stable 35 to 45% of pregnancies are unwanted. That is, societies with widespread abortion and contraception have about the same rate of unwantedness in their pregnancies as societies with relatively little contraception and abortion. So the Band-Aid that groups like UNFPA propose to put on the question of wantedness, that is contraception and abortion, we know it doesn't work, okay? We know that in fact, expansion of usage of contraception and abortion in society is not actually associated with a dramatic change in wantedness of pregnancies. Rather, if you actually want to help achieve that goal, which I think is not an unreasonable goal that every pregnancy is wanted, okay? You might instead look at underlying social and family conditions that generate unwantedness and try to address them. And the biggest underlying condition is, like you were saying, this perception that children are a burden. And there's a reality to that perception that, yes, when you have kids, it's very disruptive to the child, to your childless life. You socialize differently. You work differently. It changes lots of things. That's true. That's a real cost. But there's also the question of how we socially think about it and the kinds of norms and values and attitudes that we teach to people in health and educational systems.
Yeah, and our norms and values and attitudes towards children and family have radically changed, particularly since the 1960s. And these attitudes and values correspond with the decreasing birth rate. Today in the United States of America, there are 1.66 children per woman. In 1960, it was 3.58 children per woman. So we've seen a drastic decline in the birth rate here. We're seeing less family formation in the United States today. Fewer people are getting married. People are getting married at an older age. So we've seen a lot of our attitudes towards family and children and marriage have changed. Lyman, here's the question. Is this a result to public policy primarily, or is it a result of just the cultural mores, cultural attitudes, influence of popular culture, if you will, on our attitudes towards families and children? So is it policy, or is it just this cultural influence that we're in?
You know, I'm tempted to say it's both, but the truth is there's no difference between the two, right? We live in a democracy where the policy that we get is a product of, or we live in a republic, where the policy that we get is a product of the votes that people cast. And the reason they cast those votes is because they're part of a popular culture that gives them certain ideas and values and attitudes. And the reason we have that popular culture is partly because of the government we have and the kinds of rules of the road that it sets for how society works. So it's not really, I don't think it's actually very productive to distinguish between cultural things and policy things or cultural things and economic factors, because they work together, right? So think about something like education. People tend not to have children while they are enrolled in school. It tends to be a very strong social norm to not have children while in school. If they do have a child while in school, they tend to drop out. Is that just basic economic structure, or is that culture? Well, it's both. Obviously, the existence of school is a kind of policy thing. It changes the kinds of opportunities and earnings options that people have later in life, which changes like the timing of their life, right? They get married later because they're in school longer, and then they have to get more skills after school. At the same time, it's something cultural, right? The Amish choose not to put their kids in school. The Mormons choose to have many of their kids take a year off or 2 years off to go be missionaries, kind of in the middle of college or just before college. Culture and economics go hand in hand. We can't separate the two. So yes, there are policy elements, particularly we could think related to housing, where we excessively regulate construction of new housing and make it basically impossible to build affordable housing that's suitable for families and through policy choices. And then there's also cultural things where a lot of developers, still thinking on housing here, a lot of real estate developers could be building more family-friendly housing. And if they did so, it probably would sell. Not probably, it would sell. But they don't, because there's a culture of risk aversion and wanting to only build built forms that you've built a million times before. So you know they're code compliant, you know where to get all the different elements of the process completed, and then you don't have to learn something new. So there is culture and there is policy, and distinguishing between the two is very difficult because culture causes policy and policy causes culture.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you. If you are just joining us, you're tuned into the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, your host, talking with guest Lyman Stone about demographics. Lyman, let's look at governmental policy. Are there policies in place that discourage family formation? And because we know that when a man and woman get married, they're more likely to have children. So do we have marriage discouraging public policies on the books right now in the United States?
We absolutely do. The most prominent examples of this are just marriage penalties in our tax and welfare code. So usually these happen in means-tested programs. So like the earned income tax credit or food stamps or Section 8 housing or like the CHIP program or Medicaid. So what happens in these programs is basically the government says, okay, you are low income, you're a poor parent, something like that. We're going to give you these benefits, provided that your income is below a certain level. And then if you get married to someone else who's also poor and they're also getting those benefits, you then would combine your incomes. But now your incomes, because you're married, have risen above the threshold for a married couple, or they're farther up the phase out pattern, or you're still under the threshold, but the size of the credit or the benefit doesn't double. And the result is we actually have a situation where for working class people in particular, for people, you know, who have some income, but they're not middle or upper class. They often face losing thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars worth of benefits if they get married. This is especially true for single parents. Single parents, single moms or single dads, face massive marriage penalties. And I don't just mean like, oh, they get a little bit less money, but a situation where they say, okay, if I marry the father of my child will lose their health insurance. Like, that's what kind of choice do you expect a parent to make? Trade off their kid having health care or having a piece of paper that says they're married to this person? So marriage penalties have a huge discouraging effect on marriage. We know this from decades of high-quality academic study. These can be alleviated, although it's complicated to do so and it's sometimes costly. But right now, there's actually a proposal. It just released as we are recording this, as it happens. Senator Romney released a federal proposal to reform the earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and a couple of other pieces of the tax code in a way that substantially reduces marriage penalties. And also, as it happens, extends the child tax credit to pregnancies. So there are options to do this. They can be done. It's a bit complicated. And it does require us to think a little bit more carefully about how we design a lot of our programs. Beyond that, I mean, I mentioned housing. Obviously, we need to be making it easy and affordable to build family-suitable housing. I live in Lexington. I live in a neighborhood that it's got single-family houses, it has duplexes, it has apartments. It's one of the densest. It's in the top 5% densest neighborhoods in Kentucky. And yet, I have a yard, a garage, a driveway. There's ample street parking, and yet I can also walk to restaurants, walk to a library. The point is, you can build neighborhoods that are dense, that make effective use of land, that are profitable for developers, that are desirable to live in, that are walkable and all these things that like young people want, and also that are not just, you know, blocks of, you know, 5-over-1 apartment buildings.
Lexington has very strict land use controls. In fact, they keep everything within the circle, New Circle Road, I guess, to build outside of that area is very, very difficult.
Especially on the north side. I'm on the south side of Lexington where the green belt doesn't apply. It's interesting though, because there's some things Lexington actually lacks on. So my home county, Jessamine County, in the town I'm from, Wilmore, does not allow any ADUs, accessory dwelling units, right? So I had a friend who his aging in-laws wanted to move to be closer. He's got 7 acres on the, or he's got, no, he's got, yeah, 7 acres within a city limits. He wanted to build a little house for them to live on the back half of his property. And it's totally illegal. Can't do it. He had to parcel off a chunk of his property, which was complicated. Whereas me in Lexington, I can put an ADU in my backyard. On the other hand, in Lexington, you want to actually just like build a neighborhood? Sorry, you can't do it. Whereas Wilmore, where I'm from, as long as the lots are a third of an acre or bigger, three quarters of an acre or bigger, as long as they're these big lots, you can build it. But most people don't actually want to mow 3/4 of an acre, right? They'd be happy with a slightly smaller lot size as long as they still have a decent yard. But regulations prevent them from doing that. So there are all these complications. It's all very complicated. But at the end of the day, it's an unreasonable restriction on private property rights to say to landowners, you know, it's one thing if we're talking about nuisance things like a loud, like a concert venue or a business that has lots of traffic or something like that. But if we're just talking about normal residences. It's absurd that we don't allow private property owners to build reasonable, safe residences on their property as they like.
So Lyman, we're talking over-regulation, infringing on private property rights, but there's another part of this discussion too, in that home values have skyrocketed just in the last few years. And it's very, very difficult for young people who maybe they're married, but they're thinking, I can't afford a home, and I especially can't afford children. Aren't children expensive? I mean, is this one reason why we're seeing a decrease in the population, the birth rate in this country? Is it because kids are too expensive? Speak to that if you would.
Yeah. So there are a lot of costs with kids. Housing is the biggest one because kids generally need space. And it is true that when housing becomes costlier, fertility falls. That's true. And Lexington was recently rated one of the 10 least affordable cities in the nation for young people in terms of house prices versus local incomes for people under 35. So Lexington's kind of ground zero for this kind of dynamic. It's important to keep in mind that cost of raising children is not just budget costs. It's also social norms. Okay. So I have three kids. Two of them are sharing a bedroom. The other one is a baby and she's in a walk-in closet. Once she moves out of that closet, she's going to move into the same bedroom with the other two. Okay. Because my wife and I have just decided we are okay with bunk beds. That's fine. We want to have a lot of kids. And bunk beds are how you do that. You just stack them in a room. And we like having guest bedrooms and a home office and playrooms and stuff like that. And we only have so many bedrooms. So you make do. But a lot of Americans think, no, every child needs their own bedroom. Because they have a cultural norm around individualism, privacy, these kinds of values. Untangling the economy and the values is hard because once that social norm exists that children need their own private space, if you have that, and I'm not saying that's a good or bad norm, I'm just saying it's a common norm. Once you have that norm, housing is way more expensive because for a given number of children, you need a lot more housing. So that means that when that individualistic, privacy-oriented norm for children arises, housing costs become even more important for shaping fertility. Whereas people who just say, I don't care if my kids have privacy, I'm going to stack six of them in a room, whatever. Which also, as it happens, is there's also regulations here, right? So it used to be totally legal to put as many kids as you want in a room. Now we have occupancy laws, right? That there are limits on how many kids you can put in a room. And you talk to any family that's ever had an encounter with Child Protective Services. And of course, CPS does a lot of important and good work removing kids from abusive situations that they need to be removed from. And some people would argue maybe there's a lot of abusive situations we should be removing more kids from. Okay, maybe. At the same time, the reality is, and I'm not sure if this is the case in Kentucky, but there are a lot of states where once CPS has been called, even if they find that the reason for the call was not valid, they can remove children from their parents simply for violations of occupancy rules or for not having one room per child. So these norms that we have end up impacting law and policy, which impacts people's real family life. And so if you're a family, like maybe a minority family that tends to get CPS called on them more for all sorts of reasons, and you're worried about CPS getting called on you, then you're even more sensitive to the question, these kinds of questions. So the interaction between culture and policy is really important. And this is why people often think, well, low fertility, it's not because of economics. We're richer than we've ever been. It's because of culture. Or they'll say, no, it's not just because of culture. I mean, fertility's fallen by a huge amount in just 20 years. Culture didn't change that fast. Well, the answer is it's both. It's an interaction between the two. It takes two to tango with kids and with falling fertility.
Lyman, are you aware of any research that measures the happiness of couples that have children as opposed to couples that don't, or even individuals who never got married? The reason I'm asking this is because a case has been made that, like we're talking about, kids are a burden, they're a lot of work, they're expensive, and you're going to have a less fulfilled life if you have children. That's the cultural narrative anyway. But is there research? I'm aware of anecdotes I can speak personally on this, but are you aware of any research that speaks to human happiness, those couples that have children compared to those who are childless?
Yeah, there is. And in general, it's consistent with the idea that children have a modestly positive effect on happiness. Modestly, it's not huge, okay? But what I will say is that research actually has a big problem because not all children are the same, okay? In particular, there's a big difference between a person who was trying to conceive a child, and they wanted that child, and then they have the child and they get it, and a person who did not want to have a child and then finds themselves to be pregnant. Those may have very different effects. And we actually know this because there are some surveys where we can look at this, and we can see that if for people who want a child and they have a child, it has a large positive effect on happiness, and that effect lasts quite a long time. Okay. And on the other hand, people who want a child and don't have it. So like the classic case of this, where we can look at like random failure to have a child is with IVF failures. So people who use IVF and then do not succeed to have a child versus similar people who use IVF and do have a child. IVF failure is associated with a considerable increase in prescription of antidepressants, antipsychotics, and anti-anxiety medications. So that tells us that, yeah, wanting a kid and not having it is associated with a lot worse mental health. We have a variety of studies that show that wanting a kid and having it is associated with a happiness increase. But what about people who don't want a kid and have it? For those people, we see that there is a decline in happiness in the short run. In the long run, there's no big effect either way on happiness for those people. Though I did mention earlier, unwanted children have higher rates of adverse outcomes of a variety of kinds. So what we can say is the evidence is a bit mixed on just children in general. And the evidence suggests that when people say they don't want to have kids, they do mean it. And trying to bully them into having kids they don't want isn't great for anybody. But for people who want kids, yeah, having kids is associated with a lot of happiness and value and satisfaction in life. And if you want kids and you're not able to fulfill that want, it's associated with a lot of disappointment and sadness in life and getting to the end of your reproductive years with a sense of something missing.
Very good. Lyman Stone, thank you so much for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters. And thank you all for tuning in. Until next time, may God bless you.